Fascinating and insightful summer I spent navigating the secret and sometimes highly dysfunctional subculture of the NFL's highest executive levels. And although this adventure didn't lead to any great job offers, it did bring me something even more valuable, a deeper understanding of and improved procedures for the most challenging and important transaction in sports, hiring a head coach. After spending the 1995 season in Cleveland as the director of player personnel, I was offered a chance to stay in another role, but chose to move on. I had 2 years remaining on my contract, but my phone was ringing off the hook for meetings and special assignments, in part because potential employers figured they could get me on the cheap. In the NFL, no one is allowed to get paid twice, to double dip. Every contract has an offset clause that essentially says that a team is only responsible to make up the difference if a former employee's new job pays less than his old deal. This language is often enforceable even if a person takes a job in television. Any job connected to football activates an offset. That was all fine with me, though. It gave me an opportunity to fulfill a career goal. When I was a scouting assistant in San Francisco in the 1980s, Bill Walsh told me that Al Davis had taught him more about football than anyone else, and ever since I had dreamed of working for the Raiders. While I waited for that moment, I read everything I could about what Davis thought and how he behaved, anything that helped me understand what made him so successful. Inevitably, our paths crossed. At the scouting combine in Indianapolis, we became friends. Not surprisingly, our friendship centered on football. Before long, he was calling my home, usually late at night, to talk about the draft or a coach or some player who had caught his eye. Once in 1992, my mother Jane was over watching our kids while my wife Millie and I were celebrating the end of draft season. Davis called while we were out, and my mother, who had no earthly idea who he was, had a 10-minute conversation with him about jazz singer Billy Eckstein. Davis was a charmer when he wanted to be. When Millie and I returned home, my mother said, "Michael, this nice man Al called. You better hurry up and call him back." When he called in the summer of 1996, it was about a job as a senior assistant. Of course I accepted, not realizing that I had stepped into the crossfire of one of the NFL's longest-running feuds between two of its highest profile and stubbornest owners. In one corner, Browns owner Art Modell, a button-down, league-first company man. In the other, Davis, one of the game's great renegades. My summer in NFL exile was just getting started. Davis was prepared to hire me at a reduced rate, knowing gleefully, perhaps, that Modell would make up the difference. But when I told Modell about the deal and his tab, he was not pleased. In fact, he made it perfectly clear that there was no way in hell he'd pick up Davis's bill. His stance was not about the money, or me. It was about who was on the other side of the transaction. Modell went so far as to tell me he'd pay my whole salary just to prevent me from helping out that son of a bitch in Oakland. I knew then there was no way Modell would let me out of my contract to work for Davis. Blocked from my dream job by my old boss, I began to look elsewhere. I spent one lovely day in the desert with Arizona Cardinals owner Bill Bidwell. I had heard that in the 1970s, Don Coryell got the head coaching job with the Cardinals after writing a note to the Bidwells that impressed them. So I had done the same thing, knowing that the team wasn't happy with its front office situation. But because the guy whose job I wanted was still under contract, we had to be a little secretive. Bidwell picked me up at the airport and drove me to his house, where we talked all day in his pool cabana. He must have enjoyed the conversation as much as I did, because as we headed back to the airport, he blurted out, "I don't care if anybody knows we're meeting. Let's stop by the office. I want to show you our facility." It was a late Friday afternoon in June, though, so really there was little risk of anyone being around to spot us. Once Bidwell brought me to the office, I figured I was in. Now, you might think it was wrong to interview for a job that isn't open, but morality and the NFL management have a dicey relationship. Campaigning for someone else's job is just part of the landscape. We've all had it done to us, and we've all done it to someone else. Whenever you hear a front office guy talk about transparency or trust, make sure to take it with a grain of salt. First, if I declined the interview, Modell most certainly would have argued that I was violating my contract by not actively looking for work. Second, how was I to know what Bilwell told anyone about our meeting? That was on him. You just cannot say no to an owner who wants to meet. As it turned out, Bidwell never offered me a job or made changes to his front office, but I didn't regret the trip one bit. A few months later, the Rams called, and I found myself jetting off to the Midwest for my Frankie Five Angels meeting. Well, not exactly jetting. The view out the window of the small prop plane, basically cornfields and more cornfields, might have appealed to some, but not to a guy who left a New Jersey beach town on a way too early flight. Upon landing at General Wayne A. Downing Peoria International Airport, I was greeted by a familiar face, David Rosano, a West Coast area Rams scout whose dad gave me my NFL start in San Francisco. Over the next 90 minutes, heading south along Highway 24, we traded remember whens, as Rosano made it clear that the Rams were pretty much devoid of every positive organizational quality we'd experienced with the Niners. For starters, Shaw had orchestrated the team's move with Ortmeier from Los Angeles after the 1994 season, was still running things remotely. Like the wizard behind his curtain in Oz, Shaw controlled everything in St. Louis from his office 2,000 miles west on Pico Boulevard. From my initial conversation with him, it was also clear that he was already thinking of making a coaching change if he didn't see dramatic improvement in 1996. Rosano and I were used to one man running the show. In San Francisco, there was never any confusion about who set the direction and made the decisions. Walsh. But in St. Louis, the GM Ortmeier had little authority over roster moves. When it came to college prospects, Shaw listened only to John Becker, vice president of player personnel. And on the subject of free agents and other pro prospects, Shaw relied on the Giddings Scouting Service. Teams pay a lot of money to companies such as Giddings to help evaluate their own roster and players around the league, and in the car headed to my meeting, Rosano indicated that this service was Shaw's Bible. All of which left Ortmeier with little power or juice in the Rams hierarchy. The previous season had been the Rams' first in St. Louis. Despite the move from L.A., and a first-year NFL head coach, Rich Brooks, the Rams finished 7-9, and that was after losing the final three games all at home while giving up 121 points in the process. Seven wins under those circumstances should have created optimism in the Rams camp. But by the time Rosano turned into the Western Illinois University parking lot, I had a pretty good sense that no one was happy with Brooks. The rest of the front office, I was about to learn, already had gone to the dogs. Having just spent 5 years with Bill Belichick in Cleveland, three as the director of pro personnel and two as a player personnel director, essentially fulfilling the duties of general manager, I knew I could help this team. But when I sat down for my meeting, Ortmeier's assistant was busy training her puppy in the team's office. And it was clear from the get-go that the Rams GM was way more interested in the pet than discussing what I could offer. Ortmeier used every yelp the pup made to avoid engaging with me. I mean, I like dogs as much as the next guy, but if he asked how the little fellow was doing one more time, we were going to have a different kind of Godfather moment on our hands. Belichick, by the way, is a real dog lover too, but I promise you, he never wasted 1 minute of one day playing with a mutt in the office. I thought I was being punked by Ortmeier. I really did. It was just another reminder of what a professional, well-run workplace Belichick had created in Cleveland and just how rare that kind of an atmosphere is in the NFL. After three long, odd, and totally wasted hours, I was on my way back to the Peoria airport with Rosano, and even though Ortmeier promised to call in a few days, I knew a full-time job with the Rams was a longer shot than that puppy getting properly housebroken. With my job search going nowhere, I had no choice but to head to my summer home in New Jersey to wait and see how things might shake out. Luckily, I live within driving distance of NFL Films headquarters. Steve Sable, keeper of the archive there, was kind enough to give me access to the latest game tapes. Two things happen when you are between NFL jobs. The first is that you fall behind on league trends. The second, and more important, is that you quickly lose touch with the incoming draft class. Before you know it, you become obsolete. I was determined to avoid those pitfalls, and so each day I commuted 100 miles to stand in front of one of Sable's tape machines. Sable was a real retro guy, a lover of the 1950s old music and old school diners. He loved the history of the game most of all, and that was displayed in archival photos that lined the walls in his office and every other wall in the building. Visiting NFL Films is like walking around the Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. But the nostalgia and independent study distracted me for only so long. The truth was that in a matter of months, I had gone from watching games in a cushy chair on my own big screen at the Browns facility to coming tantalizingly close to breaking down film in Oakland with Al Davis to manning a 5x8 monitor with no remote and no chair crammed in a corner of a warehouse in South Jersey. But hey, if you love the game, you make do. Meanwhile, the Rams started the 1996 season 1-5, reinforcing Shaw's lack of faith in his leaders. Not that anyone in St. Louis had any clue what he was thinking. Because he remained in L.A. and worked for an absentee owner, Shaw was free to operate in the shadows, making moves and wielding all the power without being seen or sharing his thoughts with the people doing the work on the ground in St. Louis. Shaw's way of doing business might seem mysterious and less than ideal, but it's a pretty good example of why so many coaches hate front office types. Walsh always believed that general managers of losing organizations survived because they were firmly in the owner's comfort zone, commanding quite a salary while doing very little. He loved to speculate about what a dinner would look like with an owner, a general manager, and a personnel man of a losing team. Over martinis, the GM says, "Look, we have the best facilities and administration and exhibition schedule. We set up everything just right to get the job done." Over appetizers, the personnel man says, "Well, we had a great draft. I know because I read it in the papers." By the time dessert arrives, the owner would have been convinced that the team had everything it needed to win a Super Bowl, except they'd be wrong because they wouldn't have the most important thing, a decent coach. Give him credit. That's exactly what Shaw was thinking when he called me later to arrange a second meeting in St. Louis. For that one, Shaw also invited his first lieutenant, Executive Vice President Jay Zygmunt. Hailing a cab from the airport, I headed to Shaw's apartment in downtown Clayton, Missouri, a weekend retreat that was both office and residence for him when he was forced to come east for games or organizational get-togethers. Because of the tight travel turnaround his assistant had scheduled for me, I knew Shaw was going to get right to the point. There would be no puppies this time. When I arrived, Shaw was sitting at the far end of a long banquet table where he announced that he was not happy with the direction of the team, which was a little weird considering that he was its main architect. What he wanted me to do was spend the next 2 months researching the qualities of successful NFL head coaches, and then create a list of candidates who fit those parameters. He was emphatic about me being thorough in my research so that he would have the unimpeachable data necessary to dump Brooks at the end of the season. As I cabbed back to the airport, 1,000 ideas ricocheted around my head. I was excited and grateful to get out of the NFL Films basement and into an actual assignment. I just wasn't at all sure how or where to begin such a monumental task. I've always been fascinated with the careers of great coaches. My last name is Lombardi, after all. I already knew everything there was to know about the Green Bay legend. That would be a good groundwork for my portfolio of great head coaching characteristics. I also had extensive firsthand knowledge of both Walsh and the young Bill Belichick. Lombardi, Walsh, Belichick. What traits did those men share, and how could I assess them accurately for Shaw? My head swam the whole way home. Quickly, though, I mapped out a plan. Over the next month, I evaluated every head coach who had led his team to a Super Bowl since 1984, the year I entered the NFL. I devoured all I could on all of them, their beginnings, influences, career trajectories, trying to uncover common threads. I didn't care if they had gotten their start on the offensive or defensive side of the ball. Winners come from both. Nor did I care what positions they might have coached early on. If the Steelers had listened to those who said offensive line coaches don't make great head coaches, they never would have won 4 Super Bowls under Chuck Knoll. Plus, having spent 3 seasons in Cleveland with another tremendous offensive line coach, Kirk Ferentz, I knew they could definitely be head coaching material. Ferentz eventually got his dream job and proved me right with 143 career wins and counting at the University of Iowa. But the deeper I dug, the more data I accumulated, the further it took me from a conclusion. Before I knew it, I had dozens of amazing, highly successful coaches with a wide range of backgrounds and experiences on my list. But what was I missing? Why couldn't I connect the dots? Then, one day sitting in a makeshift home office with my 5-year-old son Matthew and SportsCenter playing on a loop in the background, it clicked. As I studied former Kansas City Chiefs and Buffalo Bills head coach Marv Levy, I had my Jerry Maguire epiphany. Coaches are first and foremost great leaders. Good coaches may be clever play callers or demanding drill sergeants or organized middle managers. But in the ultimate team sport, real success doesn't depend on tactics or discipline or order. It always comes down to how well a coach leads. I substituted the word leader for coach, and my research was transformed. I needed to define what made a great leader. I immediately turned to the works of Tom Peters and Warren Bennis, the management gurus we studied during my days with the 49ers. They had established a handful of standard leadership qualities that I could apply, supplemented by my own hard-learned insight to just about any coaching candidate throughout history and into the future. Those qualities were as follows. Command of the room. Followers need something to commit to. Great leaders know how to grab a team's attention and then show them what they're all fighting for. As Belichick says, unless a commitment is made, there are only promises and hopes, but no plans. You can't buy into a plan unless one is laid out clearly and plainly for the entire franchise. On the first day of preparation for Super Bowl 49, Belichick stood in front of his Patriots in the team meeting room and told them, "We have to understand how to play this game in order to win." Then once he had their attention, he carefully explained how he intended to win the game. He never raised his voice, never made dramatic gestures. His voice barely wavered from his usual monotone. But when I looked around the room as he spoke, everyone was taking notes. He wasn't interested in what happened the week before. He spent no time reminiscing about what got them to that moment or what the outside world was saying about the burgeoning Deflategate. He cared only about what was ahead and how to move forward with a collective blueprint that gave them the best chance of victory. But this kind of alpha dog magnetism goes only so far. No one can command a room better than John Gruden. Gruden, now back for his second shift with the Raiders after going 95-81 with Oakland and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers between 1998 and 2008, has incredible communication skills, but his words sometimes work against him. To hear him tell it, Gruden never has enough offensive talent for the schemes he has devised. Without fail, the last team he coached was more talented than his current one. How do I know this? I was with him in Philadelphia when he was the offensive coordinator and I was the pro personnel director. He would walk around the office complaining, "Can you believe I have to play these guys?" before rattling off names such as Ricky Waters, Charlie Gardner, and Irving Fryer. By all accounts, those guys were at the very least competent pros, or I could argue far better than that. But to Gruden's eyes, there was always something wrong with each of them. When I moved to Oakland, he was there too, and believe it or not, given the exact same speech, though with a twist. This time, he let it be known that the talent he coached in Philadelphia was far superior to what he was currently saddled with. I heard Gruden being interviewed once by a TV production crew as a background for a Raiders nationally televised game, and as usual, he was complaining about his lack of offensive talent. John, do you realize that your quarterback, Rich Gannon, is having an MVP season? That's when I realized Gruden told this no-talent story as motivation for himself. None of it was about his team. He was pushing himself to work harder and smarter. Problem is, it's not exactly the best way to develop trust and respect in your players, and eventually it will backfire. If he was better at this part of the job, better at coping than complaining, he could still be one of the greats. But if he hasn't learned from his first tour, he'll end up flaming out again, just as he did after winning the Super Bowl in Tampa Bay. Command of the message. What good is a plan if you can't articulate it? Part of what made Hall of Fame coach Bill Parcells an exceptional leader was his brilliant communication skills. Watch clips of him as he addresses his team and listen to the simple metaphors he uses to help players understand. If he wanted better teamwork, he might say, "We're not playing solitaire out here." Short and sweet, it drives home the point and it isn't going to be misunderstood. Parcells was a master at using humor and metaphor. Belichick, in contrast, is better at using video to detail exactly what might happen if players don't follow the plan. His bluntness is a beacon. "Look at this idiot operating on his own, not doing what he should do," he might say, pointing to the screen with an object of his ridicule as likely to be a Pro Bowler as a third-string fill-in. Whether you use metaphors or game films, delivery isn't as important as meaning. Players can't accomplish anything unless they can visualize the path. Command of self. Personal accountability is the ultimate sign of strength. When a leader admits mistakes, it shows the team that he expects as much from himself as he does from his players. When a coach cuts a high draft pick or an expensive free agent, it may look bad in the media, but it has a big impact in the locker room. No one ever complains about the long hours in New England because Belichick's car is always the last to leave the team parking lot. He will never ask players or staff to do any more than he's willing to do. In his play Antigone, Sophocles sums it up best. All men make mistakes, but a good man yields when he knows his course is wrong and repairs the evil. The only crime is pride. Ego is the leading cause of unemployment in the coaching world. Those who thrive in this profession don't place their needs ahead of the team's. Of course, some ego is essential. It becomes a problem when it gets in the way of your decision making. The right kind of ego demands perfection, not praise. Walsh most definitely had an ego. He did not deny the genius label that others gave him. He loved the attention, but it never clouded his vision for the franchise. Likewise, few in football have ever managed their egos the way Belichick has. He is not worried about where an idea comes from. He only cares about whether it makes the team better. He knows that as a man running the organization, he's going to get credit by default, so he makes sure to spread it around. That's a rare thing in the NFL. Rarer still are coaches who can admit when they're wrong. The NFL is full of insecure coaches who won't admit a mistake or share credit. In fact, they may even steal an idea or two. By contrast, you will constantly hear Belichick proclaim to his staff and players, "I screwed that up," or "That's on me." Command of self means sharing the blame and the credit alike. And this offers the advantage of allowing Belichick to step in at crunch time and say, "We did it your way and it didn't work. Now we're going to do it my way." Being honest with oneself is the first step and the one that coaches often are reluctant to try, especially someone new to the profession. Take Jim Harbaugh as an example. When I was in Philadelphia in 1997, Ray Rhodes, the head coach, asked me to find a special teams coach. I went through my research and recommended two guys, Rich Bisacci from Clemson University and John Harbaugh from Indiana. We offered the job to Bisacci, but when he chose to stay where he was happy, we happily hired Harbaugh. 4 years later, when I was working in Oakland, Al Davis asked me to find a former NFL quarterback who might make a good coach. Because of my friendship I had built through John with the Harbaugh family, I brought up his brother Jim, who had just ended his playing career. We made him an assistant. Jim was amazing from the start. He was one ex-player who really did have a great understanding of the game. What he needed work in was the other facets that defined a great head coach. Computers and analytics were just coming online, and Jim, like a lot of us back then, had no idea how to use them. More troubling, though, was that he couldn't quite organize his thoughts into a coherent plan or message. It's one thing to know the game, quite another to be able to teach it. Jim worked hard to become the kind of clear-headed communicator the position demanded. The competitiveness and work ethic he had as a player may have even increased when he became a coach. That's unusual. More often than not, it's the other way around. One late night, working alone in his makeshift desk room in a room he shared with another Raider assistant, John Morton, Harbaugh fell asleep on top of his keyboard. His nose landed on the M key, and when he woke up several hours later, there were pages upon pages of M's on the screen. I guess even back then, he knew he would end up back in Ann Arbor. Command of opportunity. As I formulated the pillars of leadership that would inform my coaching evaluations, I began to pick out the current men who fit them. It didn't take long to confirm that Belichick was one. After helping Parcells and the Giants win a pair of Super Bowls, he was considered one of the best defensive coordinators in the game. But his 36-44 record as a head coach in Cleveland included only a single playoff win. Few football people consider Belichick worthy of one of the most precious gifts in life, a second chance. If my recommendation to Shaw was going to be Belichick, I needed more support to prove my case. So I went back digging, this time for instances in which a second chance hire proved to be the best choice. More often than not, looking for a coach in the NFL is a long walk down the statistical path of least resistance. That is, straight down win-loss avenue. Just looking at records, though, without considering how they were amassed, is a pretty shallow and lazy way to find your most important employee. Belichick, for example, took over an aging team in Cleveland that needed to be rebuilt. Making matters worse, he had to overcome a declining quarterback, Bernie Kosar, with a huge new contract and the power that comes from the owner calling him the most important man in the organization. On top of that, it was the first year of the salary cap, a confusing and game-changing paradigm shift in the economics of the NFL. Within that context, the staff and culture Belichick was able to build in 5 seasons was a monumental achievement, not the failure implied by an overall record that was 8 games under .500. To this day, people ask me what the difference is between the Cleveland Belichick and the New England Belichick. My answer is always the same: very little. Okay, so he inherited a better team in New England and picked a Hall of Fame quarterback in the 6th round of the draft. Some might say Tom Brady fell into his lap. Nonetheless, he made the pick that everyone else had the chance to make too. But Belichick as a leader and the core beliefs he instilled were the same in both places. The difference people perceive is not with Belichick, but with the owner. In New England, Robert Kraft approved of, even demanded a culture change, and gave Belichick nearly total control of football operations to achieve it. In Cleveland, Modell was both a meddler and a steadfast proponent of the status quo. If Belichick seemed bellicose with the Browns, well, you would be too. It's one thing to lose because you failed as a leader. Quite another to watch your lifelong dream go up in smoke because of restrictions assigned by outside forces. The biggest lesson Belichick learned in Cleveland was that he would take another head coaching job only if the right owner offered it. The more I thought about Belichick's circumstances, the more I found myself circling back to Marv Levy, another example of a coach who overcame failure to grow and improve as a leader. A Harvard graduate, Levy had a quiet, professorial way about him, but his background in special teams had honed his ability to command and motivate. He was clearly a leader first. In fact, he may never have called a single play. But he was a successful head coach in the Canadian Football League and was on his way to becoming a successful NFL coach with the Kansas City Chiefs until the 1982 player strike got in the way. Levy had been on an impressive upward curve in Kansas City. 4-12, 7-9, 8-8, and 9-7 in his first four seasons. But the Chiefs locker room was full of hardcore advocates for players' rights, and that adversely affected the team's chemistry once the strike ended. They went 3-6 during the strike year, and he was let go. No one expected to hear from Levy again. He had his shot at the big time, and it didn't work out. End of story. But 4 years later, when Bill Polian became the Buffalo Bills general manager, he looked past Levy's one bad year and hired his old friend from their days in the USFL with the Chicago Blitz at midseason. Four Super Bowl appearances and 112 regular season wins later, Levy is firmly ensconced in Canton and serves as a patron saint for second acts in the coaching profession. I was sure Belichick, who was back with Parcells assisting him in New England, would thrive the way Levy had if he was given the opportunity. You see, becoming an NFL head coach is a process. You learn on the fly. It's a lot like the advice the late, great Glenn Frey, frontman for the Eagles, once got about songwriting from Bob Seger. The veteran Detroit rocker told Frey that to make it in the music business, he would have to write his own songs. "What if they're bad?" Frey asked. "Oh, of course they're bad. Just keep writing until they're good," Seger told him. That's what being a first-time NFL head coach is like. It's more than likely you're going to be bad at it. You just have to keep working at it until you get good. Then pray you don't end up a one-hit wonder. Essentially, Modell already had paid for Belichick's head coaching apprenticeship, and in my mind, at least, that should have been enough to vault him to the top of Shaw's list. But coaches are a bit like cars. Once they've been used, their value goes down because buyers, GMs and owners, are looking for that new coach smell. A team that needs a coach usually needs to win back its fan base. Though my research showed that it's a ton of hidden value in second chance coaches, most owners and fans see them only as retreads. Command of the process. None of the other pillars matter if the leader is not fair and consistent. When Jim Mora was the head coach of the Atlanta Falcons, his best player, D'Angelo Hall, bought a Bentley that was delivered to training camp on the night of a team bowling event. Mora had told the Falcons to ride to the event together on the bus, but Hall balked. He wanted to take his new wheels for a spin. Instead of sending a message that no one is above the team, not even when it comes to an off-season social event, Mora chose to appease his star. Making matters worse, he chose to ride shotgun. Wrong call. Playing favorites poisoned the Falcons' locker room, and bending the rules eroded Mara's authority. 6 months later, he was out of a job. That situation might not seem like a big deal, but every move a leader makes is analyzed by the team, and any one of them can have far-reaching consequences. If the team bus rule can be broken, what about curfew or red zone assignments? That's why Brady never gets a pass on Belichick's rules. When the Patriots play at home, the quarterback stays in the same hotel, in the same kind of bed, as the rookie free agent who just made the team, even though the superstar's big house and supermodel wife are less than 15 miles away. When rules don't apply to everyone, the ensuing chaos collapses whatever the foundation a leader has tried so hard to build. I've always loved the movie Patton, with George C. Scott in the title role as the hard-charging, ivory-handled, pistol-carrying commander of the Third Army in World War II. In the opening scene, as the general addresses the troops before the D-Day invasion, he quickly demonstrates all five areas of leadership. He commands his troops' attention, and it communicates his message. His perfectly balanced humility and pride show a clear command of self. He has bounced back from numerous setbacks, and he has unwavering commitment to the process, in this case, the battle plan. "No bastard ever won a war by dying for his country," Patton shouts on the screen. You win it by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country. Having settled on my pillars of coaching leadership, I was on to phase two of my search for the Rams' next general, finding potential candidates. Each of the winning coaches I examined usually had three or four of the five leadership traits I was looking for. Losing coaches, or those who couldn't sustain excellence over time, rarely had more than two. Most NFL coaches have a plan and the communication skills to teach and implement it. What separates good coaches from great ones is often trust and accountability. And so that was what I focused on over the next few months as I prepared my report for Shaw. On a Friday in December 1996, before the 4-9 Rams were to face the Bears, I flew to yet another clandestine meeting with Shaw and Zygmunt. I didn't have to be worried about being discovered because our rendezvous was purposely scheduled for the day before the team and the press descended on the city. Nevertheless, inside the thick 3-ring notebook that contained my massive report, I used numbers 1 through 7 instead of section titles so that if people caught a glimpse of it, they wouldn't be able to connect it back to the Rams or know what was contained within it. Section 1 featured the background and summary page for every successful coach currently working in the NFL. Bill Cowher, Mike Holmgren, Jimmy Johnson, Marv Levy, Bobby Ross, Marty Schottenheimer, and George Seifert. At the end of the section was an introduction to my tenets of coaching leadership. Section 2 dealt with out-of-the-game coaches who might be available for hire. This featured a breakdown of their skill sets, as well as a section called, If You Hire This Guy, that described what things would be like working with that coach, how he operated, how he treated his staff and players, how driven he was. To go deeper into this topic, which I think is key to hiring the right guy, I included a section with specific questions to ask during any potential interviews. This chapter had Bill Parcells, Jim Morris Sr., Denny Green, Dan Reeves, and Mike Dicka, with their prospects ranked in order of who I would recommend, starting with Parcells. Section 3 featured current coordinators who displayed the leadership qualities I laid out in the first section. My guys and my order ranking, Chan Gailey, Pittsburgh Steelers offensive coordinator, Emmett Thomas, Philadelphia Eagles defensive coordinator, Gary Kubiak, Denver Broncos offensive coordinator, Pete Carroll, 49ers defensive coordinator, Vic Fangio, New Orleans Saints defensive coordinator, Sherman Lewis, Packers offensive coordinator, Bill Belichick, Giants assistant head coach, John Gruden, Eagles offensive coordinator, and Cam Cameron, Washington's quarterback coach. Section 4 covered college coaches and focused on Michigan State's Nick Saban, Northwestern's Gary Barnett, Florida's Steve Spurrier, Miami's Butch Davis, and Cal's Steve Mariucci. Most of my recommendations in this section included a caveat. Because I hadn't worked with most of these guys, I needed to interview them before I could give them the full Lombardi stamp of approval. Section 5 was devoted to organizational structures of successful NFL teams. It was a not-so-subtle message to the Rams' brain trust. This is how winning franchises operate. Section 6, my gratis breakdown of the Rams roster and how Shaw should tweak it if he wanted to win. Section 7 was my official recommendations. I graded my top choices in all the leadership areas and offered examples to illustrate my assessments. I explained that any candidate who wasn't strong in these pillars simply didn't make the final list. I included the career arc of each and insight from former coaches and players. I also predicted the ability of each to handle the job. I hoped I would have the chance to spell out for Shaw a couple of other broad takeaways as well. In particular, I wanted to talk about what happens when an owner hires a guy because he has at least shown proficiency managing one side of the ball with the hope he will cover his blind spots with other talented coaches. The problem, though, is that such a setup makes creating a unified culture almost impossible. I call it the Vienna problem. Austria's capital offers alluring highlights of many different countries, like the coffee of Turkey, the intellectualism of Germany, the pastries of France, the brandy of Armenia, the art from all over the world. It is that cultural variety that makes Vienna an international tourist destination. But what works for cities doesn't cut it for teams. Vienna would never win a Super Bowl. The little of this, little of that approach has a very slim chance of overall success. And that's what you get when you have a lot of subcontractors and no visionary architect. Take Rex Ryan, former head coach of the New York Jets and Buffalo Bills. Ryan is great with a quote and quick with a prediction. And in his first two seasons with the Jets, he appeared to have the qualities of a successful head coach. But in the end, it was a mirage. Rex knows defense and loves coaching it. When he became a head coach, though, he still acted like a defensive coordinator. He left his offensive staff on an island. He subcontracted out half his team so that he could stay in his own familiar world. It got so bad that in training camp, drills were set up for the defense to win, and most of the important preparation for the season focused on that side of the ball. The offensive staff never felt like it was part of Ryan's inner circle. I was ready to tell Shaw that this division never works. The coaching staff has to be united. Ryan's Vienna approach made success impossible. I also planned to warn against copycatting. Hire an assistant coach from a successful program, this thinking goes, and hope he'll duplicate that success. Kind of like how horse breeders count on former champions to produce future ones. It's a practice that makes for contented stallions and a whole bunch of colts who never get out of the gate. Check your racing form for one, Marty Mordingwick. Many head coaching candidates come to their interviews with a huge notebook filled with a season's worth of practice sessions. I don't understand why this is perceived as a selling point, but I know how it became one. Blame it on Mike Holmgren's former teaching colleague, Bob Lamont, who quit his school job and began to represent Holmgren in 1992 after he became head coach of the Packers. Since then, Lamont has expanded his agent business, becoming a league power broker with a stable of young coaches and front office candidates. He is known for spending lots of time preparing his candidates for their interviews, preaching attention to detail and thoughtful planning. He has even written a popular book on how to impress owners that pushes those skills. Lamont filled an important void in helping men prepare for the big job, holding summer seminars on team building. Andy Reid, now the head coach of the Chiefs, was an early Lamont success story, hitting the ground running in his first head job with the Eagles, even though he had never been an NFL coordinator. But Reid thrived at least as much because of his leadership qualities as because of Lamont's curriculum. He has never lived up to his early promise, though, for reasons I will discuss later. Mordingwick, the former head coach of the Detroit Lions, is another of Lamont's clients, well-versed in the Holmgren school of detail and planning. In fact, Mordingwick's mannerisms and inflections remind you of Holmgren's. Mordingwick has always been a good offensive coordinator, but when it came time to don the headset, it didn't take long to see that he did not possess the leadership skills of a Holmgren or Reid, skills he couldn't learn at Lamont Academy or read out of a notebook. When he won just 5 games in 2 years in Detroit, it reaffirmed for me, although organization is important, leadership is what really rules in the coaching ranks. My first suggestion to Shaw would be to surreptitiously gauge Parcells' interest in running the entire organization. He checked off all the boxes, but there was no reason to court Parcells if, as I suspected, there was no chance he'd accept the position. It diminishes the team and whoever they eventually hire if it leaks out that the guy wasn't exactly their first choice. A little high schoolish, yes, but the optics matter. After Parcells, my top picks were Saban, Belichick, Barnett, Carroll, Gailey, and Fangio. I felt so strongly about Saban that I told Shaw not to let money or control get in the way. As for some of my other recommendations, Carroll certainly has proved my faith. Barnett has as well. Why Fangio never got a chance? I'll never know. And Gailey? If he never reached his potential as a head coach in Dallas, I suggest that not many do operating in Jerry Jones's world. I did not know then that history would vindicate my research, but in any case, I was proud of the work I put in and the product I produced. On the cab ride from O'Hare, I collected my thoughts and went over my presentation one more time. I was dressed in a coat and tie, hoping to project a sense of gravity, professionalism, and attention to detail that made one of us. I handed over the notebook and watched Saul half-heartedly scan in seconds what took me months to compile. He seemed instantly disappointed. Saul thought I had a blind spot for Belichick, and he was probably right. I favored a guy who would become the greatest coach of all time. Go figure. Remember, though, this was a long time before all the Lombardi trophies in New England, and at the time, Belichick was a newly fired sub-500 head coach who had a terrible reputation as a guy who couldn't get along with media or persuade established players to buy into his concept. Belichick also had to answer for his handling of local hero Kosar's release, which infuriated the city of Cleveland. Shaw and the other naysayers had no idea what a disruptive force Kosar had become in the locker room after losing his job to Vinny Testaverde. Shaw dismissed my Belichick recommendation out of hand without reading one bit of the research. As for Saban, he was even less enthused, if that was possible. Shaw's first experience with a college coach, Brooks, hadn't gone well, and he had no interest in hiring another. It didn't matter that Saban had coached more than 5 years in the NFL and had run a defense that allowed only 204 points in 1994. Saban arrived in Cleveland as Belichick's first hire. After 1 year as the head coach of the University of Toledo, he was chosen to be the Browns' defensive coordinator. From the first practice, any football observer could tell he had the makings of a fruitful head coach. He had a strong plan and an effective way of communicating that plan, and his ability to be self-critical earned the players' trust in a way that rivaled their feelings for Belichick. Saban was different from his old boss in many ways. For starters, he was more vocal and quicker to anger, and he was always well-dressed and well-groomed, never a hair out of place. Belichick was the opposite. Hair usually messed up from sleeping on the couch, always in some form of team gear with his trademark scissor-cut sleeves. But these two were similar in the ways that counted. Intelligence, decision-making, leadership, making them a true odd couple and an incredible team. Separately, they are simply two of the finest coaches I have ever seen. But sitting in his hotel suite chair, mindlessly leafing through my work, Shaw had the look of a guy who considered my information and conclusions to be worthless, which might explain why he never paid me a dime for any of it. And I had the distinct feeling he was going to throw away my notebook as soon as I left. Eventually, Shaw convinced Dick Vermeil, the old Eagles coach, to come out of retirement to be the Rams head coach and director of football operations. At least Shaw listened to me about the advantages of picking someone with head coaching experience. Vermeil didn't do much initially to justify the hiring. In his first two seasons in St. Louis, he won a total of 9 games. In his third year, his leadership qualities began to shine through, and he made the most of his own second chance, winning 13 games and the Super Bowl. Things worked out well for Shaw and the Rams. As for me, I left the hotel suite in Chicago and headed back to the airport without a job or a paycheck, at least not until the next January when the Eagles hired me as their pro personnel director. What I did have, though, was something much more valuable, a notebook full of priceless research and insider knowledge regarding the evaluation and hiring of the most important position in sports, information that has benefited me every day since. I'll never say that nothing good came out of that bizarre summer of 1996. Chapter 3, Team Building, In Search of Program Guys. We are not collecting talent, we are building a team. Bill Belichick. El Camino Real, the King's Highway, is a well-known thoroughfare that stretches from San Diego to San Francisco. On Tuesday, in April of 1986, the road that once linked California's Spanish missions carried me on an early morning pilgrimage from my townhouse in Mountain View to the San Francisco 49ers office in Redwood City. There is nothing easy or simple about the imperfect science of team building in the NFL, except maybe the commute. In those days, the NFL draft was still a midweek affair that began with a yawn and a whimper at 8 a.m. on a Tuesday in New York. The 5 a.m. start time for the 49ers staff put me, by then a West Coast college scout for the team, on El Camino Real at 2:30 a.m., when the normally jam-packed highway was empty with nothing but green lights the entire way. Call it the calm before the most important draft in 49er history. Soon enough, NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle would walk to the podium at the Marriott Marquis in New York City's Times Square and announce Auburn running back Bo Jackson as the first pick of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. But we were in a much trickier spot. For starters, the 49ers were picking 18th, a spot that didn't bode well for a burgeoning dynasty. If it was rather high for a team that had won a Super Bowl 2 years earlier, it was also a bit low for a team that had just finished second in the NFC West. There were 28 teams in the NFL in 1986. Under Bill Walsh's leadership, the 49ers franchise was no longer accustomed to second-place finishes or to being beaten decisively in the wild-card playoffs by the New York Giants with our high-octane offense held to 3 points in the process, as we were in 1985. It was clear, as we headed into the offseason, that the owner, Eddie DeBartolo Jr., would not tolerate another lackluster finish. Of course, the only person more eager than his boss to make the necessary draft day tweaks to the team was Walsh himself. The coach believed that securing a handful of new starters, including an elite pass rusher and upgrades in the backfield, was our ticket back to the Super Bowl. In 1986, the draft was really the only way to find those players and to build or rebuild a team. Despite all the changes to the economics of the game during the last 30 years, that's still very much the case. If anything, the finite resources teams now have under the salary cap, more on that in a bit, have only made the relatively inexpensive young talent in the draft even more valuable, and the grand art and science of talent evaluation and team building even more important. Back then, though, free agency didn't exist. When a player's contract expired, his team essentially retained control of him. There was the occasional difference-making trade, but for the most part, in 1986, draft picks were the gold, and Walsh needed to find his fortune. It didn't matter that his scouts and personnel people were calling that year's draft the worst ever. That just made him crazy. I mean, he would go nuts stepping back with, "We only need to find 12 good players," before stomping away in disgust. Walsh hated that kind of defeatist chatter, not least because if it was true, how could he ever improve his team? He didn't care what the rest of the league was doing or thinking or whining about. He simply wouldn't tolerate excuses. That extended even to speaking badly about a prospect. If someone needed to be critical of a player's talent, he was to keep it professional. Stay clean and to the point and don't denigrate. Words such as sucks or blows had no part in a report. "It's our job to find talent, not dismiss it," he told me. His dignified single-mindedness led us to work harder than ever that spring. Leading up to the 1986 draft, there was an unusual sense of urgency even for the workaholic like Walsh. That winter, he seemed to always be calling me to fetch film of a prospect or work with the phones in search of more information. My job was to be on call at all times to help him with whatever he needed. That included invitation-only Saturday sessions in which Walsh and the 49ers staff discussed in great detail the players each of them had scouted over the previous week. Walsh controlled the meeting with his probing questions, reminding the presenters to always highlight what could the player do for the 49ers. That is, how he specifically fit our schemes or needs. Through it all, he took notes on his ubiquitous 3x5 cards, leaning my way and whispering instructions whenever he needed supplemental information. On draft day in 1986, driving through the inky, deserted darkness of El Camino Real, I thought a lot about those Saturday staff meetings and everything I had learned during the frantic 3 months of nonstop work that led up to the draft that would build a dynasty. I've never forgotten the main takeaway from that year. It remains just as relevant and vital more than 3 decades later. The game of football might be ruled by perfectionists, but at its core, success in the NFL comes down to managing the maddening inexact science of talent evaluation and team building. And when it comes to predicting human performance on a football field, the only thing for certain is that nothing is ever for certain. Despite the thousands of man hours and millions of dollars teams invest in the draft every year, a recent study showed that teams still get it wrong on almost half of their top draft picks. The imperfect nature of team building is why Walsh and all the other great football minds I've been around have approached the eternal puzzle of personnel the same way. Instead of trying to solve or perfect the draft, they figured out how to create an edge by developing methods, strategies, and insights, things such as deeper background checks, better character evaluations, and more thorough off-season evaluations that minimize risks and improve the odds of building a better team. Few mastered these techniques better than Walsh. That's why, as I pulled into the San Francisco facility on the morning of the 1986 draft, I was overcome by the strangest feeling in our business: confidence. One of Walsh's draft mentors was Al Davis himself, whom Walsh had worked for earlier in his career. Having spent time with both legends, I saw firsthand how Davis influenced Walsh's ideas about team building, especially the importance put on a prospect's pedigree. Both Davis and Walsh understood that digging deep into a draft pick's background could be indispensably informative. For one thing, Davis believed that any player who demonstrated rare talent in high school needed to be considered carefully regardless of how he played in college. After all, his prep potential could have been squandered by poor coaching or a mismatch in talent and scheme. Davis believed in this theory so deeply that he carried around a file of old Sunday Parade magazines so that in free moments he could pore over the tissue-thin pages that listed past Parade High School All-America teams in hopes of uncovering a forgotten diamond. In 1985, Walsh had called me into his office to give me one of his special assignments. He wanted me to give the top three receivers in the draft, Al Toon, Eddie Brown, and Jerry Rice, the Davis treatment. Calling high school coaches wouldn't do. I was to go deep into their backgrounds and talk to teammates, classmates, guidance counselors, girlfriends, ex-girlfriends, and anyone else who could offer insight into those young men. After finally getting to the NFL and what I thought was the big time, I ended up spending almost a month collecting data on high school wideouts. You'd be amazed at how much I was able to scare up. I did my sleuthing on East Coast time, traveling the King's Highway in the middle of the night, getting in before 5 a.m., and working the phones from one of the back meeting rooms. Spiral notebooks open before me, I called possible sources, throwing the 49ers name around in hopes that it would loosen lips. More often than not, it did. From guidance counselors and coaches alike, the information flowed. I made and received calls all day long. Each time I hung up, the phone would ring again. I always answered because I knew that if Walsh had the right information, he would make the right decision. Somewhere in my stuffed notebook, I was going to have the right information. A little surprisingly, Brown emerged as the clear local hero. He was revered at Miami High School, eliciting raves from coaches who worked with him and faced him. His athleticism and quickness were awe-inspiring. The Bengals thought so too. That's why after the Jets took Toon with the 10th pick overall, they grabbed Brown with the 13th, leaving us with Rice. He worked out pretty well, I think we'd all have to agree, but who knows what kind of name Brown could have made for himself in the NFL if he had dropped into our laps. Another background area that Davis taught Walsh to care about was track and field experience. Davis was forever on the lookout for 100-meter champions from states he deemed fast, such as California, Florida, Louisiana, and Texas. Impressive times from places such as Minnesota didn't carry the same weight because Davis assumed they were win-aided. Davis, by the way, also was obsessed with shot putters, discus throwers, and state wrestling champs, athletes who displayed rare balance, great footwork, and explosive power. This scouting cheat had led the 49ers to Jeff Stover, the University of Oregon's Pac-10 shot put champ, whom Walsh called the most consistent lineman on San Francisco's 1984